14. Hiro stares at the miniature TV in the upper left corner of the card. It zooms toward him until it's about the size of a 12-inch low-def television set at arm's length. Then the video image begins to play. It's very poor 8mm film footage of a high school football game in the 60s. No soundtrack. What is this game? The librarian says,
Odessa, Texas, 1965. L. Bob Reif is a fullback, number 8 in the dark uniform.
This is more detail than I need. Can you summarize some of these things?
No, but I can list the contents briefly. The stack contains 11 high school football games. Reif was on the second-string Texas All-State team in his senior year. Then he proceeded to Rice on an academic scholarship and walked onto the football team. So there are also 14 tapes of college games. Reif majored in communications.
Logically enough, considering what he became.
He became a television sports reporter in the Houston market. So there are 50 hours of footage from this period, mostly outtakes, of course. After 2 years in this line of work, Reif went into business with his great-uncle, a financier with roots in the oil business. The stack contains a few newspaper stories to that effect, which, as I note from reading them, are all textually related, implying that they came from the same source.
A press release.
Then there are no stories for 5 years.
He was up to something.
Then we begin to see more stories, mostly from the religion sections of Houston newspapers, detailing Reif's contributions to various organizations.
That sounded like summary to me. I thought you couldn't summarize.
I can't, really. I was quoting a summary that Dr. Lagos made to Juanita Marquez recently, in my presence, when they were reviewing the same data.
Go on.
Reif contributed $500 to the Highlands Church of the Baptism by Fire. Reverend Wayne Bedford, head minister. $2,500 to the Pentecostal Youth League of Bayside. Reverend Wayne Bedford, president. $150,000 to the Pentecostal Church of the New Trinity. Reverend Wayne Bedford, founder and patriarch. $2.3 million to Reif Bible College. Reverend Wayne Bedford, president and chairman of the theology department. $20 million to the archaeology department of Reif Bible College, plus $45 million to the astronomy department and $100 million to the computer science department.
Did these donations take place before hyperinflation?
Yes, sir. They were, as the expression goes, real money.
That Wayne Bedford guy, is this the same Reverend Wayne who runs the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates?
The same.
Are you telling me that Reif owns the Reverend Wayne?
He owns a majority share in Pearlgate Associates, which is the multinational that runs the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates chain.
Okay, let's keep sifting through this, Hiro says. Hiro peeps out over his goggles to confirm that Vitali is still nowhere near the concert. Then he dives back in and continues to go over the video and the news stories that Lagos has compiled. During the same years that Reif makes his contributions to the Reverend Wayne, he's showing up with increasing frequency in the business section, first in the local papers and later in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. There is a big flurry of publicity, obvious PR plants, after the Nipponese tried to use their old boy network to shut him out of the telecommunications market there. And he took it to the American public, spending $10 million of his own money on a campaign to convince Americans that the Nipponese were duplicitous schemers. A triumphal cover on The Economist after the Nipponese finally knuckled under and let him corner the fiber optics market in that country, and by extension, most of East Asia. Finally, then, the lifestyle pieces start coming in. L. Bob Reif has let his publicists know that he wants to show a more human side. There is a personality journalism program that does a puff piece on Reif after he buys a new yacht, Surplus, from the U.S. government. L. Bob Reif, last of the 19th century monopolists, is shown consulting with his decorator in the captain's quarters. It looks nice as it is, considering that Rife bought this ship from the Navy, but it's not Texan enough for him. He wants it gutted and rebuilt. Then shots of Rife maneuvering his steer-like body through the narrow passages and steep staircase of the ship's interior. Typical boring gray steel Navy scape, which, he assures the interviewer, he's going to have spruced up considerably.
You know, there's a story that when Rockefeller bought himself a yacht, he bought a pretty small one, like a 70-footer or something. Small by the standards of the day. And when someone asked him why he went and bought himself such a dinky little yacht, he just looked at the guy and said, "What do you think I am, a Vanderbilt?" Well, anyway, welcome aboard my yacht.
L. Bob Rife says this while standing on a huge open-air platform elevator, along with the interviewer and the whole camera crew. The elevator is going up. In the background is the Pacific Ocean. As Rife is speaking the last part of the line, suddenly the elevator rises up to the top and the camera turns around, and we are looking out across the deck of the aircraft carrier Enterprise, formerly of the U.S. Navy, now the personal yacht of L. Bob Rife, who beat out both General Jim's defense system and Admiral Bob's global security in a furious bidding war. L. Bob Rife proceeds to admire the vast flat open spaces of the carrier's flight deck, likening it to certain parts of Texas. He suggests that it would be amusing to cover part of it with dirt and raise cattle there. Another profile. This one shot for a business network, apparently made somewhat later. Back on the Enterprise, where the captain's office has been massively reworked, L. Bob Rife, Lord of Bandwidth, is sitting behind his desk having his mustache waxed. Not in the sense that women have their legs waxed. He's having the curls smoothed out and restored. The waxer is a very short Asian woman who does it so delicately that it doesn't even interfere with his talking, mostly about his efforts to extend his cable TV network throughout Korea and into China, and link it up with his big fiber-optic trunk line that runs across Siberia and over the Urals.
Yeah, you know, a monopolist's work is never done. No such thing as a perfect monopoly. Seems like you can never get that last 0.1%.
Isn't the government still strong in Korea? You must have more trouble with regulations there.
L. Bob Rife laughs.
You know, watching government regulators trying to keep up with the world is my favorite sport. Remember when they busted up Ma Bell?
Just barely. The reporter's a woman in her 20s.
You know what it was, right?
Voice communications monopoly.
Right. They were in the same business as me. The information business. Moving phone conversations around on little tiny copper wires one at a time. Government busted them up. At the same time when I was starting cable TV franchises in 30 states. Can you believe that? It's like if they figured out a way to regulate horses at the same time the Model T and the airplane were being introduced.
But a cable TV system isn't the same as a phone system.
At that stage it wasn't, because it was just a local system. But once you get local systems all over the world, all you gotta do is hook them together, and it's a global network. Just as big as the phone system. Except this one carries information 10,000 times faster. It carries images, sound, data, you name it.
A naked PR plant. A half-hour television commercial with no purpose whatsoever other than to let L. Bob Rife tell his side of a particular issue. It seems that a number of Rife's programmers, the people who made his systems run, got together and formed a union, unheard of for hackers, and filed a suit against Rife, claiming that he had placed audio and video bugs in their homes. In fact, placed all of them under 24-hour surveillance, and harassed and threatened some programmers who were making what he called unacceptable lifestyle choices. For example, when one of his programmers and her husband engaged in oral sex in their own bedroom one night, the next morning she was called into Rife's office, where he called her a slut and a sodomite, and told her to clean out her desk. The bad publicity from this so annoyed Reif that he felt the need to blow a few million on some more PR.
"I deal in information,"
he says to the smarmy, toadying pseudo-journalist who interviews him. He's sitting in his office in Houston, looking slicker than normal.
"All television going out to consumers throughout the world goes through me. Most of the information transmitted to and from the CIC database passes through my networks. The metaverse, the entire street, exists by virtue of a network that I own and control. But that means, if you'll just follow my reasoning for a bit, that when I have a programmer working under me who is working with that information, he is wielding enormous power. Information is going into his brain, and it's staying there. It travels with him when he goes home at night. It gets all tangled up into his dreams, for Christ's sake. He talks to his wife about it, and God damn it, he doesn't have any right to that information. If I was running a car factory, I wouldn't let workers drive the cars home or borrow tools. But that's what I do at 5 o'clock each day all over the world when my hackers go home from work. When they used to hang rustlers in the old days, the last thing they would do is piss their pants. That was the ultimate sign, you see, that they had lost control over their own bodies, that they were about to die. See, it's the first function of any organization to control its own sphincters. We're not even doing that. So we're working on refining our management techniques so that we can control that information no matter where it is, on our hard disks or even inside the programmers' heads. Now, I can't say more because I got competition to worry about, but it is my fervent hope that in 5 or 10 years, this kind of thing won't even be an issue. A half-hour episode of a science news program. This one on the controversial new subject of infoastronomy, the search for radio signals coming from other solar systems. L. Bob Reif has taken a personal interest in the subject. As various national governments auction off their possessions, he has purchased a string of radio observatories and hooked them together using his fabled fiber optic net to turn them into a single giant antenna as big as the whole Earth. He is scanning the skies 24 hours a day, looking for radio waves that mean something. Radio waves carrying information from other civilizations. "And why," asked the interviewer, a celebrity professor from MIT, "why would a simple oilman be interested in such a high-flown abstract pursuit?" "I just about got this planet all sewn up."
Reif delivers this line with an incredibly sardonic and contemptuous twang, the exaggerated accent of a cowboy who suspects that some Yankee pencil neck is looking down his nose at him. Another news piece. This one apparently done a few years later. Again we are on the Enterprise, but this time the atmosphere is different again. The top deck has been turned into an open-air refugee camp. It is swarming with Bangladeshis that L. Bob Reif plucked out of the Bay of Bengal after their country washed into the ocean in a series of massive floods caused by deforestation farther upstream in India. Hydrological warfare. The camera pans to look out over the edge of the flight deck, and down below, we see the first beginnings of the raft. A relatively small collection of a few hundred boats that have glommed onto the Enterprise, hoping for a free ride across to America. Reif's walking among the people, handing out Bible comics and kisses to little kids. They cluster around with broad smiles, pressing their palms together and bowing. Reif bows back, very awkwardly, but there's no gaiety on his face. He's deadly serious. "Mr. Reif, what's your opinion of the people who say you're just doing this as a self-aggrandizing publicity stunt?" This interviewer is trying to be more of a bad cop.
Shit, if I took time out to have an opinion about everything, I wouldn't get any work done, Elbob Reif says. You should ask these people what they think.
You're telling me that this refugee assistance program has nothing to do with your public image?
Nope. Ugh.
There's an edit and they cut away to the journalist, pontificating into the camera. Reif was on the verge of delivering a sermon, Hero senses, but they cut him off. But one of the true glories of the library is that it has so many outtakes. Just because a piece of videotape never got edited into a broadcast program doesn't mean it's devoid of intel value. CIC long ago stuck its fingers into the network's videotape libraries. All of those outtakes, millions of hours of footage, have not actually been uploaded to the library in digital form yet. But you can send in a request, and CIC will go and pull that videotape off the shelf for you and play it back. Lagos has already done it. The tape is right there.
Nope, look. The raft is a media event, but in a much more profound, general sense than you can possibly imagine.
Oh.
It's created by the media, in that without the media, people wouldn't know it was here. Refuse wouldn't come out and glom onto it the way they do. And it sustains the media. It creates a lot of information flow. Movies, news reports, you know.
So you're creating your own news event to make money off of the information flow that it creates?
Says the journalist, desperately trying to follow. His tone of voice says that this is all a waste of videotape. His weary attitude suggests that this is not the first time Reif has flown off on a bizarre tangent.
Partly. But that's only a very crude explanation. It really goes a lot deeper than that. You've probably heard the expression that the industry feeds off of biomass, like a whale straining krill from the ocean.
I've heard the expression, yes.
That's my expression. I made it up. An expression like that is just like a virus, you know? It's a piece of information, data that spreads from one person to the next. Well, the function of the raft is to bring more biomass, to renew America. Most countries are static. All they need to do is keep having babies. But America's like this big old clanking, smoking machine that just lumbers across the landscape, scooping up and eating everything in sight. Leaves behind a trail of garbage a mile wide. Always needs more fuel. Ever read the story about the labyrinth and the Minotaur?
Sure, that was on Crete, right?
The journalist only answers out of sarcasm. He can't believe he's here listening to this. He wants to fly back to L.A. yesterday.
Yeah. Every year, the Greeks had to pony up a few virgins and send them to Crete as tribute. Then the king put them into the labyrinth, and the Minotaur ate them up. I used to read that story when I was a kid and wonder who the hell these guys were on Crete, that everyone else was so scared of them that they would just meekly give up their children to be eaten every year. They must have been some mean sons of bitches. Now I have a different perspective on it. America must look to those poor little buggers down there, about the same as Crete looked to those poor Greek suckers, except that there's no coercion involved. Those people down there give up their children willingly, sent them into the labyrinth by the millions to be eaten up. The industry feeds on them and spits back images, sends out movies and TV programs over my networks, images of wealth and exotic things beyond their wildest dreams, back to those people, and it gives them something to dream about, something to aspire to. And that is the function of the raft. It's just a big old krill carrier.
Finally, the journalist gives up on being a journalist, just starts to slag Elbob Reif openly. He's had it with this guy.
That's disgusting. I can't believe you can think about people that way.
Shit, boy, get down off your high horse. Nobody really gets eaten. It's just a figure of speech. They come here, they get decent jobs, find Christ, buy a Weber grill, and live happily ever after. What's wrong with that?
Rife is pissed. He's yelling. Behind him, the Bangladeshis are picking up on his emotional vibes and becoming upset themselves. Suddenly, one of them, an incredibly gaunt man with a long, drooping mustache, runs in front of the camera and begins to shout, The sounds spread from him to his neighbors, spreading across the flight deck like a wave.
Cut, the journalist says, turning into the camera. Just cut. The Babel Brigade has started up again.
The soundtrack now consists of 1,000 people speaking in tongues under the high-pitched, shit-eating chuckles of L. Bob Rife.
This is the miracle of tongues, Rife shouts above the tumult. I can understand every word these people are saying. Can you, brother?
Yo, snap out of it, Pod.
Hero looks up from the card. No one is in his office except for the librarian. The image loses focus and veers upward and out of his field of view. Hero is looking out the windshield of the Vanagon. Someone has just yanked his goggles off his face. Not Vitali.
I'm out here, Gogglehead.
Hero looks out the window. It's YT, hanging onto the side of the van with one hand, holding his goggles in the other.
You spend too much time goggled in, she says. Try a little reality, man.
Where we are going, Hero says, we're going to get more reality than I can handle.
As Hero and Vitali approach the vast freeway overpass where tonight's concert is to take place, the solid ferrous quality of the Vanagon attracts magnapoons like a Twinkie draws cockroaches. If they knew that Vitali Chernobyl himself was in the van, they'd go crazy. They'd stall the van's engine. But right now, they'll poon anything that might be headed toward the concert. When they get closer to the overpass, it becomes a lost cause trying to drive at all. The thrashers are so thick and numerous. It's like putting on crampons and trying to walk through a room full of puppies. They have to nose their way along, tapping the horn, flashing the lights. Finally, they get to the flatbed semi that constitutes the stage for tonight's concert. Next to it is another semi full of amps and other sound gear. The drivers of the trucks, an oppressed minority of two, have retreated into the cab of the sound truck to smoke cigarettes and glare balefully at the swarm of thrashers, their sworn enemies in the food chain of the highways. They will not voluntarily come out until 5 in the morning, when the way has been made plain. A couple of the other meltdowns are standing around smoking cigarettes, holding them between two fingers in the Slavic style, like darts. They stomp the cigarettes out on the concrete with their cheap vinyl shoes, run up to the Vanagon, and begin to haul out the sound equipment. Vitali puts on goggles, hooks himself into a computer on the sound truck, and begins tuning the system. There's a 3D model of the overpass already in memory. He has to figure out how to sync the delays in all the different speaker clusters to maximize the number of nasty, clashing echoes.